Our text that we come to is in the middle of a section in which the Lord Himself is really hitting the reset button, we might say. It's not a resetting of His purposes with regard to Israel, for those remain eternal and firm and secure, but it's really a restarting of His appointed messenger, Moses. You remember how they began and how they started off on this mission. We are told all of that account in chapter 5. In chapter 5, Moses and Aaron go with high expectations, and so do the people. But the initial brass refusal of Pharaoh to even acknowledge God and even to allow the children of Israel to go, coupled with the bitter rejection of his own brethren because of the increased labor and quotas that were set upon them, and even Moses' own complaining retort to the Lord, have really themselves fallen to the ground except for the grace of God Himself. Moses has complained at the very end of chapter 5, and God, as we saw last Lord's Day in chapter 6, verses 1 through 9, responded with reassurance. Reassurance at this initial failed expression and anticipation of deliverance. And so God Himself now is resetting, as it were, the stage, resetting the prophet himself for the work that he's about to do. This divine assurance that came in verses 1 through 9 of Exodus 6 came principally in terms of who God is and what God will do. You may remember four times in those nine verses, it was peppered with this term, I am the Lord. I am the God who reveals myself as the controlling, sufficient, effecting reality in the world. I am the God who is about to make a new revelation and manifestation of myself, and it will be manifested in terms of my deliverance of Israel. I am the Lord. And we heard also in those words of assurance at least eight times the Lord's declaration, I will, I will, I will. The Lord Himself is going to be the actor. And this is the way in which He seeks to restart and to reassure Moses. It's an interesting account. Moses indeed goes and appears reassured by the words of the Lord in the first eight verses of chapter 6. But we are told the response as he went back to the people of God with the assurance that God Himself had given. We are told that Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and their cruel bondage. It met with deaf ears. They were in no mood for any more promises. They themselves were wounded and bruised, and their own hearts were not ready to listen and be encouraged. And it is in this context that now we come to the text that I want us to consider that goes through chapter 7 and verse 7. This is really almost a sense I've used it re-engaging. I would call it locked and loaded, because this is the final preparation for the wonderful work that God is going to do. Because after this section, after verse 7, the deliverance begins in earnest by the hand of God of His people. And so this is really the precursor leading up to it. This is the preparing again of His servants, Moses and Aaron, for the task which God has set them on. And so I begin we're going to be looking at two sections here. We're going to look at that very brief section which I read in verses 10 through 13. Moses and Aaron are re-engaged in the work. And then we're going to have in the genealogy of verses 14 through 27, Moses and Aaron reviewed in terms of their lineage, reviewed in terms of their roots, reviewed in terms of their those who would descend from them. And then finally, we're going to have Moses and Aaron again in the latter part, beginning in verse 28. We're going to have them reinforced. Reinsurance comes again. And so God is equipping His servants. He's re-engaging them in the task. So let us look at verses 10 through 13 first. This is Moses and Aaron re-engaged by the Lord. And on the heels of this discouraging response by the people of Israel to the encouragement that God had given Moses to give to them, the Lord speaks to Moses. It's interesting. For eight verses, The first 8 verses of chapter 6, it has been marked by the I wills, I wills, I wills, I wills of God. And we might get the impression that Moses would think, maybe there's nothing else for me to do. God himself has already filled up Moses' ears with assurance of his own acts. But notice how it begins. It begins, go tell. I will, I will, I will, now you. You do what? You go and tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of his land. God has assured Moses what he will do, but now he tells Moses what he must do. And what we note here, it may not be particularly noteworthy, but this is what we should observe. Moses' task remains unchanged. It is what God initially told him to do. And the setback really is not a reason to draw back at all. The mission must go on. The calling still remains to Moses to be the spokesman for God. A royal refusal and a brotherly rejection has not changed the task for Moses. And the Lord reminds him of that. He's not to stand down, but he is to move forward in faith and obedience. He is not the deliverer of God's people. The Lord is. But the Lord reminds him that he is the servant. He is the Lord's instrument. And his calling is simply this: go and tell. It is not a massive work which he is to do. It's not the heavy work. It is a very simple work. It is to go and to declare what God tells him to declare. It is simply to be the messenger. And as he did with the initial calling, we see Moses again halting and balking. Notice his response to that reminder and that re-engagement of the task that is unchanged, verse 12. But Moses spoke before the Lord. Behold, the sons of Israel have not listened to me. How then will Pharaoh listen to me? If I can't even get a hearing from my own kinsmen of a message of divine reassurance, how do you expect Pharaoh to listen to me when I come to him with divine command? It's interesting how Moses hedges here. The Lord has never told him in any place that Pharaoh will listen. Indeed, he has some expectation indeed about what his ministry is to accomplish. God has simply told him to go and tell. God has not promised him that Pharaoh will listen, and in fact, he has originally told him he will not. You might remember in chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go. He isn't going to listen. He isn't going to respond. Moses, you never should have been surprised. The task is not changed. It isn't going to be anything, in fact, that you do or say. It is going to be me, because I'm going to stretch out my hand and I'm going to strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I will do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. It's not what you say. I am calling you. I am directing you to go and to make the demands in my name. That's what I'm calling you to do. And in fact, what we considered this morning and what we've already considered looking at the book of Exodus, in chapter 4 and verse 21, the Lord told Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I will put in your power, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. The Lord has instructed Moses what he should do and informed him what Pharaoh will do because of what he, God, will do. Obedience to the divine call, dear saints, and all of the callings that God gives to us, whether we are husbands or wives or fathers or children or employers or employees or citizens, our obedience is not dependent on the results of our obedience. Our obedience is simply to be faithful to what God tells us to do. The Lord has made plain his part. Moses must do his. And the answer to Moses, how will he listen to me, is in the hands of the Lord. And in fact, the obedience doesn't hang on the how of its outcome. It depends on the who of the command. Moses has forgotten the who part. For he says, I am unskilled in speech. It didn't depend on you in the first place, Moses. It depends on God Himself. And of course, this does answer it, doesn't it? The answer to Moses is, how is he going to listen, is the fact that indeed he will not. Because God has determined that he will not. He will not hear. The calling upon Moses is simply to obey. Our callings are not based or measured by our skill or lack or credentials or experience. Our calling is determined by what God tells us to do. And that is what Moses, again, still has to learn. That's the amazing truth here. But I want us to see what takes place, verse 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron. It appears, at least the way the narrative proceeds at this point, that Moses' objection is ignored. The Lord just moves forward, or at least the narrative moves forward without any kind of response to Moses' need for reassurance. It is really interesting here. He just simply says, he gives them a charge to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And that's where it stops. That's where it stops. It's going to move forward at the very end of chapter 6. The narrative is going to be taken up again. There has been the re-engagement. Moses himself must learn to obey. But now we come to this other part here, this part that we want to consider. And this is the part that probably makes us want to go to sleep. This is the genealogy. What in the world? In the middle of this, all of a sudden, here we're coming, we're moving to in this divine drama. This resolution now in which it appears that God, having made assurance, having redirected His servant, having charged them to give the word to Pharaoh and to the people of God, that the hand of God is about to be moved on behalf of His people, all of a sudden we're brought to an intermission. And the intermission is a genealogy. It's almost like watching some suspenseful account, some kind of maybe TV series, and in the minute that that we come to the very resolution of the suspense, there's a commercial. That's not probably the intention here of this genealogy. The intention of this genealogy, because they aren't necessarily put in to create suspense, but probably to make us stop and review and think about what's going on. And what he's doing now is he's setting the stage upon which the very deliverance will take place. And he's setting the stage on the backs and on through the identities of the very people themselves who will be delivered in this mighty deliverance. And that is what he is doing in verses 14 through 27. He's setting out this genealogy, which, like all of the genealogies of God, are basically selective. They are put together with a purpose. They are designed to be informative. And so as we come to this particular genealogy, we want to be encouraged and say, okay, exactly what is it? What is it that we are to be informed about as we look at this genealogy? I would read it for you, but again, it might speak, well, let me do it. I'm going to read you a genealogy. We're going to go through this genealogy. I want you to kind of think about it as you read through it. I'm going to bring out some points after we go through it, but again, let us read through it, because it is setting the stage. These are the heads of their father's households. The reference is to the sons of Israel at the very end of verse 13, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. These are the heads of their father's households. These are the heads of the households of the sons of Israel, whom God Himself is going to deliver. The sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, Hanok and Palu, Hezron and Carmi. These are the families of Reuben, the firstborn. The secondborn, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin, Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the families of Simeon. And then it goes to the third son of Leah, the wife of Jacob. These are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And the length of Levi's life was 137 years. And then the genealogy of the sons of Jacob.